Hello.
How's everybody?
Yeah, that's what you say at the first panel of South by Southwest. Everybody's like, yeah, panels today. And then tomorrow it was like, panels. And then the third day, fuck it. So, hey, thanks for coming. I know it was raining out there, and we really appreciate you guys braving the weather to make it all the way out here to the Radisson. We're excited to be here. We've got a lot of really cool stuff to talk about, some stories to share. We will assuredly make some mistakes up here, and we know that you can understand that, but hopefully we will be able to share some stuff that is interesting and maybe life-changing at the same time. So welcome to Designing for Context. We want to get started on some interesting stuff. So first thing you might notice is the hashtag that South by Southwest has provided us is incorrect, or at least we feel it's incorrect. So we've changed it. It is now D4C, Designing for Context. And if you notice, we also have a website, d4c.org, which has, among other things, the slides that you're about to see. We've already just posted them up there, so you can either follow along or download them. We also will have, I think, the Twitter stream that's happening, yeah, based on the hashtag. So if you guys want to get yourself up on a website, you can use the hashtag. See everybody over there? So that's it. So follow along, make the back channel a lot of fun. We'll try to have some fun up here, and let's get right to it.
Okay, so no discussion of context would be complete without going back to 1995. And specifically to something called the Decision Theory and Adaptive Systems Group.
I'd like to apologize for that.
So this was a group at Microsoft led by a guy named Dr. Eric Horvitz, and they studied something called Bayesian methods, and they were really into these Bayesian methods, and they thought that they had figured out in 1995 the exact moment, the exact context when somebody became frustrated with an interaction. And they thought they had figured that out in 1995, and that all that stuff essentially led to this, which you could make an argument. I don't have anything personally against Clippy, but you could say that it's the most hated feature in the history of computing.
Computing.
What happened is, you know, they tried to do everything right. They had Dr. Eric Horvitz is a smart guy. He still works at Microsoft, and he led a team of PhD researchers there that studied people, their context. Now, at that time, their context was a desktop computer, and it was, you know, Microsoft Office suite. And still, they conducted the design research in such a way and went about beginning their design tasks where they asked people to sit down in front of prototypes, and they said, you know, what would you think if an animated character came on at the right time and offered you some help? Would that be of interest to you? And people were like, yeah, that sounds amazing. Like when I was writing a letter or something. So, you know, we all know that you know, that didn't really help. And that was 17 years ago. That was essentially one context that we were designing for at that time. And, you know, now it's a little bit different. You know, you guys are probably all here because there's a few more contexts that we have to consider as interaction designers, or even as interaction design researchers. So that's sort of, you know, the crux of this is how do we research and design for context in a way that doesn't give us hypothetical answers, that we don't ask people what they think, and that we get to some concrete stuff.
Right, so with that, we wanted to talk a little bit about the purpose of the talk, which is, of course, we can define context as the situation that people are in when they're using a particular product or service, right? That context can be defined by a bunch of different types of things. That situation could be influenced by things like location or time, multiple use cases, technology, even other people, right? So it doesn't really matter. The challenge that us as designers face is how do we deal with that? How do we approach those problems and how we try to solve for for people's problems? So I think the first question that I wanted to ask the panel up here is what are some of the craziest contexts that you guys have had to design for in the past? I think, Ben, you had a good example.
Yeah, so I'll start off, but I think it's actually a complete and utter lack of any discernible context at all. So this is for a client that I can't talk about. I'm doing work that I can't explain. we had zero access to any details about the people that we were designing for. We couldn't talk to them about any specifics. We only knew generalities. And so that meant that we were effectively designing in the dark. We couldn't discern any, we couldn't get any hooks, we couldn't get any insights that we could use for our design. But we still managed to create something interesting and meaningful for those people. The stuff that we came up with at the end of this mystery project was still somehow relevant. If you ask me how I did that, I would have to say that I don't have a fucking clue. But we did. So
that's my craziest context story.
That is a crazy story, yeah. For sure. I think one of the craziest contexts that I've had designed for is astronauts in space. When I worked with a company called Adaptive Path, and we were contacted by NASA, of all people, to try to help design applications that astronauts can use both in space on the space station as well as the shuttle and various future vehicles. And what's really interesting about that is you think, sure, I can design an iPad application. That's no big deal. You sort of tap and do stuff like that. And then we quickly realize that as soon as an astronaut taps on something in zero gravity, they go one way and the iPad goes the other way, right? So suddenly, all the conventions that we sort of had in our mind about how this would work now has to go out the door, right? So we started talking about, okay, well, how can we design for that? Do we physically add Velcro to the back of the iPad, and do we stick astronauts to the wall so that they could use this? Or what are the other ways that we can enable interaction without sort of having to deal with the low gravity and different things like that? And of course, the biggest challenge, the biggest constraints they threw at us is, hey, you know, the cosmic radiation that goes through the space shuttle on a daily basis will fry iPads. So people, we're going to have to replace these, iPads on a day-to-day basis, or not a day-to-day basis, on a mission-to-mission basis, which got me really scared about being an astronaut, because there's no way I would want to go into space and get nailed by cosmic radiation that could fry computers on a regular basis. So anyways, so designing in space is probably one of the craziest things that I've had to do. Is there any other examples, some more maybe contemporary examples that we could talk about?
Can I just say, I think you guys are total show-offs, and these examples are cool, but a lot of people actually just design for kind of mundane things that we all have to do on our computers every day. I'll represent you guys in the audience. So I've done a lot of designing for, like, checking your finances on the toilet and calling a call center.
Wait a second. We've gone from space to toilet.
It's the full human condition, obviously. So I think it's totally legit to design for mundane contexts as well, and I will represent that point of view well on this panel, I promise you.
I don't think there's actually anything more mundane than being in a situation where you have to take what is, traditionally a browser-based application or service and turn it into something that's appropriately mobile. I think there's a big vogue for mobile first right now, but if you were caught a couple years ago going browser first, you're being pushed into the mobile space. This includes my team on about.me. We are in the midst of developing a mobile app that will be available soon. But one of the advantages we got from being desktop first or browser first was the opportunity to see the behaviors that you can engender or that people will flock towards when you put a good example in front of them. One of the things we found was that people love browsing around for we watch the tweets, we watch the server logs, we see people just kind of staying on site, browsing, hitting the random button over and over again, looking at different beautiful profiles. When we decided to move into the mobile space, we decided there was kind of a big deal not to do just a one-on-one mapping, to really just kind of figure out the behaviors that we wanted to represent and capture them as best as we could. So we wanted to take things that were appropriate to a mobile context. You're not going to get super involved in curation at that point. You're actually just going to go for consumption. So we decided to kind of prioritize that. And there's this interesting thing when you realize you don't need to take an existing experience and map it over wholesale to what you're doing in a different context. It frees you up. It makes you start thinking about that idea of appropriateness, and it becomes a rubric for should we include this or should we leave it behind in the other experience. And you can start to see kind of the friction of those ideas, and what you wind up with is something that looks the same. It's consistent in experience, but it prioritizes different things. It's become part of a gestalt. It's become part of an ecosystem, a variety of ways for people to access what you've built without it being, just redundantly, consistent. I think the final piece of that is that we were able to, because we conceptually changed the way we viewed the product in this new context, we were able to start saying, okay, well, if we're doing browse and we've got something that's in mobile, it makes sense to create a location element that actually captures the browsing in locality. I think there's a lot of vogue for applications right now that take a look at the people nearby. We're interested in making that kind of a more beautiful experience, making it curated and really trying to find out what hooks people in without making it noisy, spammy, or really notification heavy. But yeah, it doesn't always have to be designing for astronauts or designing for the CIA. It's got to be...
Wait, you said it.
You can't save that.
Shit, here come the black helicopters.
Get you in the middle of this town.
Could we kill that mic down there at the end, please?
I'm under no contract.
I think they care?
It can sometimes be the standard problem that a lot of teams and services have. It's like, okay, look, there's opportunity to capture the audience somewhere else. How do we follow them in and not just be ridiculous and just do a one-to-one mapping?
So that brings us to the point in the conversation, which maybe we could talk a little bit more about some of the background that we have and so what we bring to this panel. I'd like to start off with some introductions, and maybe Leah could share with us a little bit about her background.
Yeah. So I work for Intuit, which is a company that makes software that improves people's financial lives. And prior to that, I worked for Adaptive Path for a while, and the most of my career has been in financial services. So I'm really interested in essentially how we as human beings can kind of all benefit from what should be the sort of human right of kind of financial knowledge and stability. But I come to this because our teams at Intuit are actually doing a ton of really interesting stuff around context. So I'm excited to share some examples with you guys.
Nate, you want to talk?
Sure. So my name is Nate Bolt. I'm from San Francisco. I have a small research and design firm, and we do a lot of remote intercepts with people in their sort of native environments. We also have a product called Ethnio that allows other people to do that. And I wrote a book a couple years ago about that kind of design research, people remotely sort of sharing their screen or whatever. Is Leah's picture still up? Is that weird? I'm counting on Andy here, and I just feel like he's working on the iPad.
It's better. You know, it's better looking.
Nate Bolt, ladies
and
gentlemen.
That's it.
Oh, are you done?
That's it.
Oh, okay. We'll move on to the next one. Hey, that's me. So my name's Andrew Crow. I am currently experience design director for a little company called General Electric. Prior to that, I was a vice president of mobile and experience design for Razorfish, on the West Coast there. And prior to that, I had a chance to work with almost everyone on this panel. Actually, I've worked with everyone on this panel, including Nate, but at a company called Adaptive Path. So that's it for me. Let's move on to Ben.
Hi, Ben Fullerton. This is me doing my best Nick Nolte impression. I am director of interaction design at a client services company called Method. We are based in San Francisco, London, and New York. Prior to Method, I spent time at Adaptive Path, IDEO, a short amount of time at Twitter, Samsung, and a bunch of other places. Basically, I'm an agency whore.
I don't think you're a whore.
Oh. Thanks. Nice of you to say, Ryan.
I do.
A slut, maybe, but not a whore. So, moving on.
My name is Ryan Freitas. I also an Adaptive Path alum, most recently the co-founder and now director of product at About.me, an AOL company. I've been working with my team for about a year and about 19 months, bring a identity platform to the masses. It's been a lot of fun, and it's been very interesting because having come from a services background where I worked on a bunch of different ideas, I now get to work day-to-day to kind of build out a vision that we started with nearly 2 years ago.
Excellent. So that brings us to the core of our conversation, which includes some themes that you should be aware of when you're designing products products and services for people who are using those products and services in multiple contexts. And we wanted to start with sort of hang this conversation around five different themes that we've noticed that are important for designing and sort of approaching the research and sort of development of these products and services. And I'd like to start with the first one, which of course is time. So time, I think, as most of us know in the room, time is an extremely important aspect of interaction design. It affects every interaction that we actually design for people to use. But what does it do in terms of the context of use? So we were talking a little bit earlier about this idea of long-term engagement versus maybe even, sort of, lack of a better term, a snackable or a short-term engagement with a product over time. What kind of affordances do we need to build in when we talk about designing interactions for different lengths or instances of time? Does anybody have any examples of that? I think...
Yeah, I could jump in. So, I mean, when I first started out as an interaction designer, I think I honestly didn't think about time. I mean, I thought about time in, like, the most linear, sequential way possible. It was like, okay, how can I make sure that this flow is utterly intuitive from sort of moment to moment? But I think I had this very, like, luxurious misbelief that no one's going to get interrupted. They're not looking at other things, not doing anything else when they're kind of working with this product. So a big kind of aha for me was when I realized, like, oh, people actually, not only are they doing other stuff when they're working with your products, but they actually use your stuff, they go away, they live real life, and then they come back. I did a project with ASICS back when I was at Adaptive Path, which was basically kind of like a personal running app. And it was really interesting to think, like, okay, so if you're a really serious runner, you are going to be tracking your runs. You're going to be fiddling with sort of this device or this device. Before you walk out the door, you're going to be indicating that you're about to go have this running experience. And then you go out into the world and you actually do things that are not in any way technological. And then you come back and you need to kind of be reminded that you've sort of, you left this sort of task in sort of mid-flight. So we started playing with things like, set a timer and go out and run. We started playing with things like get a snooze or a reminder and have a snooze button come to you on your phone so that, you know, you can kind of like remember that you have this sort of in-progress task. So that was really interesting. And then increasingly lately, actually, I feel like the work that I'm doing and the teams that I work with are doing, it looks at time in an even sort of broader, longer perspective. There's a team at Intuit that's been working on taking QuickBooks to the iPad, and it's fascinating when you start thinking about what if you have this product. QuickBooks is like it's like accounting software for small businesses. So what if you have this thing that's been on your desktop for 10 years collecting data about your small business, and now all of a sudden you need to design essentially what you can do when you take it into the world on one of these things. All that data becomes really interesting from a kind of features and functionality perspective. So time in these sort of like micro moments, longer moments, and then like crazy long horizons if you're lucky enough to have a legacy product that has a lot of data. Those all become really interesting fodder for design, essentially.
And I sort of have an example of the way that we're approaching this right now. So we're working with the New York Times right now. They're very interested in the different contexts that people read the paper, right, or read news. And it's a fascinating subject for me. The whole idea of what news even is today versus 10 years ago is quite different, the way that we consume it and the chunks and the size and all that stuff. But simply across devices, even if you just look at phones, tablets, desktop computers, printed media, we didn't want to, so we're designing personas for them, and we didn't want to set out to tackle the persona research and design in the traditional way, which is to be like, okay, John is a 33-year-old BMW driving architect who loves opera. You know, those kind of personas to us didn't give us any information about the context in which people are reading the news, and sort of help the New York Times understand these different audience segments better. So the way we decided to do the research was to intercept people in the moment when they were at each of these different contexts. So this is our little app intercept called Ethnio that we put that went to people on all different types of devices and just said, hey, do you have a few minutes to sort of help the New York Times? And what we would do is, even though it kind of looks like a screener intercept, you guys are probably like, wow, you put a survey on a website? That's amazing. But it's slightly different, and we would mostly ask people open-ended questions, and so it's not closed-ended data that we're after. We want to see what people type, and then we're sitting here with the team at the New York Times in the moment and watching what people type, and within a few seconds, if they say, you know, I'm on the train and I'm on my iPad, or I'm hopefully not driving, but, you know, things like that, we're looking at them in real time as they appear on this screen, and then we would call them. You know, we just click the call button and we say, hey, you know, you're in that context right now. Would you talk to us on the phone? Talk to us about what you're doing, and then maybe share their screen with us if they are on a desktop computer. And the idea is to structure the design research in a way that gets us on the participant's timeline. You know, traditionally when you do any kind of, set out for any kind of design project, you force your participants, even if it's casual research, to be on your timeline. You know, you grab people in the hallway and say, look at my app, or you schedule them 2 weeks in advance if you're at a big company to come sit in a lab. And the problem with that is you're totally shattering the real context of the participants. And this is just one way. You know, you can intercept people in the moment in any type of way, and it's all very interesting to me. But the idea is to get them get on their timeline. So that's sort of on the research side.
Nate, are you saying that now is an important time
right now,
as well?
No, now.
That's profound.
No.
Ephemeral.
No.
Well, it's interesting because one of the things we were talking about last night is this idea of when we talk about designing for time, there's, you know, Leah was talking about some financial. I want that back there right now. there's some financial ideas where, you know, if you're filling out this long form, say for you're filling out a mortgage request or a loan application or something like that, that's probably something that you're going to want to do in a place where you have a considerable amount of time, right? Maybe that's sitting in your office or your home or whatever. But when you do certain tasks, they do take a certain amount of time. So you want to make sure that you design accordingly. But at the same time, there are other tasks related to that might take a little less time. For example, just checking your checking account balance, right? So maybe you just whip out your iPhone and you just double check. So there's ways to design for time that the task actually will take, also time that you actually have in order to give to that task.
But also, I was kind of saying the exact opposite of that last night too, which was,
no,
but that's totally legit as well.
I agree that you
well.
Were completely
yes,
opposite.
Exactly. No, well, what I was saying last night actually is that I think in some ways, if you're looking for design inspiration, there's a lot to be found in asking the question, what are the things you think have to only happen when you're whipping out your phone in line really fast, versus what are the things that you think require 2 hours at your desk? The inspiration for that was this product called SnapTax that Intuit does. Intuit also makes tax software, so they do TurboTax and stuff like that. Do your taxes if you haven't done your taxes yet. But so SnapTax is this awesome thing because you can... yes, exactly. PSAs, floss as well. No, SnapTax is cool because you basically can submit a simple tax form by just actually taking a picture of your W-2 with your phone, and then you're done. So that kind of product came to be when the team started saying, like, what are the things we assume you actually have to plan an afternoon for, gather 15 paper documents, get like everybody out of the house, and does this actually subvert that? Can we let this subvert that? I mean, I think it's actually really powerful just to, in the process of concept development, to give yourself the permission and the time to say, what are the things that we think can't possibly happen when you're checking your phone in line, and then like what can we sort of make possible there? So that's, I think, yes, and also the exact opposite of the thing that you just said.
I definitely like those yes and mm-hmm. answers as opposed to yes but.
It's interesting when you're talking about breaking down what looks to be a very large or complex experience and then pulling out pieces, because one of the things that we're talking about when we're talking about context is that nothing should be held as sacred. That if you've built an experience or you're trying to build an experience, the worst idea to take into it is that there's something has to be the same way no matter where you go. Yeah. We've already talked about mapping. But the other kind of the flip side of that is when we're talking about something long term, like you're talking like 10 years of tax data, you know, on the same desktop. As we engage with products over time, something happens to our relationship with those products. They become integrated in our lives in ways that we really aren't aware of, at least at first. And over time, we can outgrow products, or we can grow into product suites. So we move on from being something, you know, just a one-to-one interaction with something, a tool that we've always used, to discovering that, okay, there's a little bit more of an extension. I think this happens with photo applications. I think, Nate, you could talk about that. Or it actually happens a lot in financial stuff, where you, at one point in your life, you actually just need some very simple tools to plan your taxes. Next thing you know, you're needing estate tax planning and the like. This emergence from interaction at this stage to widening it out, I think, goes into our next topic, which is about ecosystems.
Right, so I think there's probably not one person in this room who doesn't own a product that fits within some type of ecosystem, right? Whether that's the Apple ecosystem or any other types of ecosystem. But the challenges I think that we as designers face is that we can't design for one product anymore, right? The thing that we all design is that we also need to be aware of how those products or how those services interact with other devices, other things out there, whether they're within that ecosystem or within other, maybe even competitive ecosystems as well. So, but beyond the products, the greater ecosystem is something that we've been trying to speak to, which also includes things like social, brand, technology, and some other things. So, I'm wondering, Ben, you had this idea for a teaching channel. Do you want to explain how that?
Yes, so Teaching Channel is a project that we did at Method recently, launched last year. Basically, how we understood ecosystem for the Teaching Channel was not that it was necessarily an ecosystem of products or services, but there was a whole bunch of other activities that teachers engaged in, and we needed to understand what those were. And teachers are very time-strapped people. They have so much to take on, they have so much to plan, and the actual act of teaching takes up a large amount of their day, and it's a very engaged activity. I should know, I teach undergraduate students as well. Which is nothing like teaching in K-12, but anyway. So what we tried to do with designing the product was we understood what all these different demands on teachers' time were, And then we tried to design features into this product that actually alleviated some of the time pressure that teachers felt within their teaching practice. One example is there is a notes feature that allows teachers to, instead of having to watch an entire video on the teaching channel, mark particular points in the video to come back to later and write a little bit about what's interesting about a particular point so they can refer to it without needing to like kind of scrub or skip through an entire video.
So I think we all also have an example from Mint that we were discussing earlier.
Definitely. So Mint's actually Mint is one of another Intuit product that's been doing actually a bunch of kind of work to bring the product from its native web sort of home to various mobile devices, and that's just like you cannot help but encounter a host of ecosystem questions when that happens. The latest sort of release in that is the iPad app and now the Android tablet app. These are two different screenshots from the iPad app. And so when the team was kind of like ready to actually try to think about porting this this kind of experience, this web native experience over into an ecosystem environment, the first thing that they actually did was, I have to say, it might be the exact opposite of what you just said, Ryan, but I'll do it anyway, which is essentially saying, okay, well, what do we know about the data about how people are using mobile devices in general? And what they discovered was actually that, 30% of people are signing up in mobile devices now. And, like, the majority of people are actually entering the product through mobile, not through the web anymore. And so what that tells us is that you can't actually necessarily assume that people are going to be hitting all these different touch points in your ecosystem. In a lot of cases, increasingly, mobile may be the only face that they have to your ecosystem. And so in some ways, just saying, like, let's take our full feature set and scale it down to the appropriate size of the device doesn't always work when you realize, oh, they may never discover that that other feature set exists in other places. So for the Mint team, what that meant was that with the real estate that the iPad or that the Android tablet affords, they're like, okay, well, we need to make sure that really key things that are important for the web, like budgeting and trending and digging into these sort of luscious, beautiful graphics, that stuff all needs to like live and stand on its own in the tablet environment. So that kind of consideration, I think, was important for them. And then another really interesting thing about ecosystem thinking is that they started working on the iPad app, and they were like, this needs to be gorgeous. Obviously, we want to be like, you know, this should be a sort of a thought-leading product. And when they did that, they realized that the iPhone version wasn't really standing on its own in terms of being as gorgeous as what the iPad version is. So it sort of forced the team now to kind of retrofit the other kind of products for different touch points that they have to kind of up-level sort of beautiful design for the whole ecosystem. So it's kind of this virtuous but frustrating thing that when you start designing really well for one sort of touch point in the ecosystem, it sort of becomes an arms race of beauty for the whole ecosystem. So good for consumers ultimately, but it's a thing that you're going to have to kind of plan for when you're designing sort of for porting things over.
The effort of developing for multiple contexts is not a straight multiplier. It's more like you're dealing with, you know, large scale numbers, you know, factorials of effort that are involved in moving things over and figuring out what's appropriate and then designing well for everything you're doing, because it really is a tide that lifts all boats.
Yeah.
It's actually something that we see a lot of clients coming to us and saying is like, hey, you know, well, we have this website over here and we have maybe an iPhone app, but what we'd like the most beautiful or engaging experience to be on is the iPad. And we'd like you to like kind of figure out how that experience is as immersive and engaging as it can be, and then maybe we'll look at like elements from that and we'll port those back, in inverted commas, to the web or back to the iPhone experience. So it's kind of like prioritizing one platform as a way of developing like a hero experience for an entire brand or an entire product.
And actually, to add on that, interestingly also, what it can do is it can kind of rise expectations across different operating systems as well. I think with Android versus, you know, iOS, there's actually this interesting challenge where there's the kind of the iOS sort of mentality is like sort of designed appropriately to the device, whereas the Android mentality is sort of designed to scale. But when you design like a mobile phone like Android experience to scale, and then you put it on a tablet, it looks, you know, like dumb if you're used to seeing like whatever the equivalent of like an iPhone experience appropriately designed for an iPad is. So for the Mint team, actually, what they did is they kind of they said, okay, well, that's the convention. Like, screw it. Let's actually try to make the Android tablet experience as good as the Android or as the iPad experience with some kind of Androidifications. And then now, of course, like all the Android users are like, this is the most gorgeous app that I've seen on this tablet. So it's like it actually changes expectations for those user bases as well. So it really starts to like.
It's the most dangerous thing in the world to start treating devices as the audience instead of the actual audience. These audiences on different across devices are your users, and if you allow any segment of them to become your bastard children that you don't pay attention to, then you're obviously not in the business of experience design. You've failed the first part, which is user experience design.
So designing for multiple touch points within an ecosystem is got to be challenging enough, but I imagine that starts with some type of effort around understanding those touch points and understanding how people interact with that.
Yeah, the interesting thing that we see for startups especially is people want to understand a little bit about, you know, how their products are being used in the real world or out in different contexts, but it's expensive to go do any kind of field research. You know, if you do any ethnography or things like that, most startups are like, what? You know, we don't have budget for that. We barely have time to grab people in the hallway. And, you know, one of the interesting things we've done with Ardeo is just mixing methods, and there's so many online tools that promise to be like the UX research dream tool that's going to solve all your problems and tell you all your, you know, product roadmap. And those tools individually, I don't think offer any magic sauce, but combining them or combining methods really quickly is great. And so the exact thing that we did with Ardeo, which is so easily replicable, and I think it's close to this kind of like guerrilla research or casual research to understand the context, is we took 50 people and we gave them this usability exercise, just a random tool, and it gives people a task. It's not analytics like KISS Insights or something like that where you're just seeing fancy server data. It actually gives people a task. So the task on here would be like sign up for Ardeo and, you know, explain why you clicked where you clicked. And that could be across all different devices. So that's 50 people. It's not statistically significant. It's not like going to win every argument in a development meeting, but it's data and it's interesting. Then we take 5 people and we get the exact same tasks and we just sit down with them very casually. And we can mirror the tasks from the in-person quick casual research to this, you know, slightly more formal data. And then we also would have 10 people do usertesting.com, which is this, you know, self-moderated tool probably a lot of you are familiar with. People kind of talk into their mics and record why they're clicking where. So by combining those 3 things, all of which cost like $30 to $80 or something, they're very inexpensive, you kind of get a little more picture of these different contexts. Sometimes we have people hold their devices up to their webcams. There's a method where you, if you hug your laptop with a device, you can get a pretty good image remotely of the device. It's a quick, easy way to get a little more info about the context. And when you pair it with things like this, you know, you get a little more concrete of a picture for very little time and money. And I think it's, you know, it's just a nice way to get, at least get out and not just, you know, who's sitting next to you. And it's just a little bit fancier, but not crazy expensive.
So we've talked a little bit so far about time, and we've talked a little bit about ecosystem. I think we'd be really remiss in terms of any discussion around context if we didn't talk about location. And clearly we're all in a location here, but a few minutes ago you were in a different location with your same laptops and the same information that you're trying to access. But I think location is really huge. It dictates many of the strategic and design decisions that we make. It also affects the hardware and the hardware design and some of the choices around the services and all these things help to provide a frame of reference for external factors that users, you know, the people that we're designing for, are encountering. An example that I have from my past for working with location is working with Victoria's Secret. So at Razorfish, we worked on a couple of applications. We actually worked on multiple applications for Victoria's Secret, but 2 of the consumer applications that we put out there were one was for an iPad and one was for an iPhone. And we made an explicit choice to make those 2 completely different applications. And the reason why we did that is because we understood that the target audience had 2 different needs for engaging with Victoria's Secret products as well as Victoria's Secret as a brand. So the iPad application is all about engaging with the brand at a deeper level, understanding the products, browsing the catalog, watching videos, checking out, you know, pictures of the product and things like that. And that's something that people can do in the comfort of their home while they're planning a shopping experience, right? Trying to choose a product that they would then go out and buy. No one necessarily brings their iPad with them to the store, but they do have their phone on them. So what we wanted to do is design and develop an explicit iPhone application that worked within the context or of the location of the store. And we did that by providing different tools
for the person who's in the store, such as the ability to use the camera on the device to snapshot the UPC code, which then told them a lot more data about that particular product that they're looking for, whether that product was in stock at that store, what stores in their area had that product in stock, how maybe sizing might work, and trying to develop some type of translation there. But the idea was that people engage with the product and the brand in two completely different ways, and rather than trying to fit all that into one application and force people to navigate or self-select, why couldn't we just provide applications that worked based on the specific location that they found themselves in? There's other ideas that Intuit has been exploring.
Now is the time when I will talk about accountants.
Well,
no, I'll agree with you in that case. No, so this is a product actually, it's for accounting professionals, which I'm guessing there aren't too many of in the room here, but it's called Tax Online Accountant, and it's, so here's the thing. When we talk about location and context, it makes me crazy because I feel like everybody talks about it as this kind of augmented reality thing. Like I'm in so many meetings at work where it's like, oh, we're gonna put product X on a thing with GPS. What can we do where you like can look through the camera and see the world around you, and then new information pops up, and it's like, yeah, that's awesome. But there's other ways you can think about location, and I think this is a really nice case study of that. So the way this product came to be. Basically, what this does is it enables accountants to kind of look up your tax information on the go. And it turned out that the team that was working on this, actually a guy named Phil Omey, a designer at Intuit, he basically in the last like 2 minutes of a user interview was like, what are some things that you need to look up when you're on the go? He didn't say, what do you need to do with your mobile device? Like, what would be awesome if you could use your whatever camera or GPS? He kind of left it open-ended. And what the accountant said was, I often find that I'm walking around the office and somebody who works for me says, like, hey, what's the e-file status of, like, Miss Bewley's taxes? And then he has to, like, stop what he's doing and run back to his computer and look it up. And, it takes, like, it derails him for 4 minutes. And that kind of inspired Phil and the team to realize that like location in this context is in office. Like mobility within the workplace is a totally legitimate form of location. And I think what I love about that kind of example is that it forces you to think about location almost in these sort of radiating zones that move outward. And it's like, I think a lot of times conversation around context right now are about, I'm in a city. Oh, I'm in Austin for the weekend. Who's hot nearby me in this room right now? And instead, what you could do maybe if you're interested in this sort of thing, is say, what is an actual person sort of, what are the context, the locational context in their lives that they sort of move among, starting at home, then into their sort of hyper-local sort of neighborhood, then into their sort of broader community and outward. And if you think in a very sort of purposeful way through those different dimensions, it starts to expose really different sort of opportunities. I would just say, I think this is where service design tools are really important for interaction design professionals. I think being able to actually like sit with a person and say, draw a picture of your journey through your office where your employees are asking you questions, or show us, map out the places that you went in the day and the different people you had conversations with and the different times you took your device out and what you took it out for, all that stuff, it exposes opportunity for design.
Well, and it's interesting too. I mean, the idea that accountants moving around a very small space could open up sort of some interesting interaction design opportunities. That's kind of cool.
You wouldn't expect it, would you?
Wouldn't expect it.
You guys, accountants are hot and underserved.
Hot accountants near you.
Exactly.
I think we're done.
Yep.
We look at these same kind of things in stores sometimes, you know, so we'll go to stores. The only thing that we do that's not totally obvious when sitting in stores watching people shop or use apps or completely fail at using QR codes is to stream it live. So, you know, this is another sort of slightly not obvious use of time and context is if you just take a simple free live stream account and a whatever webcam, you know, $10 webcam, assuming you have some kind of internet connectivity, streaming an in-store observation or a field observation back to your team or to your clients is an incredible way to get them interested in what you're doing. Even if it's a lark, even if you just go on your lunch break to try and get into somebody's real context, to stream that that live and then, you know, either over text or IM or Campfire, take questions from your team about the physical environment, it blows people's minds. I mean, it's not any crazy use of internet technology. It's just live streaming. But when we did this, the team was flipping out. They were like, oh, cool. Why are they doing that? Are you sure the QR code's not working? Wait, ask them again. Can they scan the QR code? It's so still not working then. Okay. You know, and it's just a way of... it's just a way of sort of getting people excited versus playing a video of people using QR codes would make all of us want to shoot ourselves immediately. But so somehow adding that context of in the moment during the observation can also just be a kind of an exciting thing.
Can I just make one other point about location, which is this is probably like the most mundane and obvious point you could make, but if you're designing stuff that's actually used outside of a building, you have to design it so that direct sunlight and things like that actually still make it legible. We've been doing a lot of work with like mobile payment apps that you can use like at a farmer's market or something. And it's just like we've come up with some really beautiful, very sort of sleek, sophisticated designs, and they're dark as hell. And it turns out nobody can read anything on the screen when you're outside of like a room with lighting like this. So just like... actually testing the thing on the type of device that it's going to be used on in the environment that it's going to be used on is rather important.
Absolutely. So that brings us to another theme that we've been needing to discuss about context, which is form and technology. So I think it's easy to say that design for all contexts that a user encounters, you could start with the lowest common denominator, right? Which is there's this idea of mobile first, right? And you're going to hear that a lot, I'm sure, over the course of the next few days. But mobile first doesn't necessarily. I mean, what I love about the tenets of mobile first, and Ryan and I were talking about this at lunch, is the idea of boiling down the product features and the interactions and the types of things that people need to really use at a very sort of basic level, right? Sort of starting with that, and then building on top of that when it seems appropriate, right? So starting with if you're talking about mobile, right? What's the basic type of experience that you need, and because of the constraints that mobile devices impose, that's a good way to sort of then sort of pare down and really find the concentrated value of the product that you're designing for. And then, of course, you can expand as your screen size expands or as multiple other types of technologies come into play. Of course, does that mean that we need mobile devices or mobile versions of everything? No, I don't think that's true, because there's a lot of other types of devices that are just more than PCs and mobile, right? I work for General Electric, and we've got lots of different devices out there. We've got things like healthcare products, radiology machines. We've got transportation, like gigantic locomotives that don't have any type of a mobile component at all, but that still doesn't stop us from at least pairing all the way back to the core needs that the end user needs, and sort of building upon that as a platform for designing as well. What do you guys think about sort of technology and size factors and form factors? How does that sort of play in terms of a constraint or a benefit to some product design decisions?
I think you were just talking about kind of the constraints of the different technologies and then the scaling down that they require. And I sort of feel like I like to look at it the opposite way and think about the capabilities that the different form factors sort of provide and then what that makes possible. Mm-hmm. So, I might have a slide for like that product SnapTax that I mentioned. But so that's like, okay, so doing your taxes on your mobile phone. Well, if you start to run down the list of things that your mobile phone can do, you realize like, okay, there's camera, there's audio capture, there's clearly like touch, there's your GPS. Like all of these things are, they're assets. And what SnapTax has done successfully is they've used camera and they've used OCR. Are you making jokes about my...
I'm saying that we're talking about affordances and constraints.
Yes.
And so we're talking about Don Norman shit, like, again.
Well, it's still relevant because
Absolutely.
Anyway, so my point is though that I think being purposeful and actually leveraging the capabilities of the device, it sort of makes new opportunities. And interestingly, with the SnapTax example, people really love that you can take a picture of your W-2, but it actually takes longer to take a picture of your W-2 and to like check all the data that the data is correct than it would take to key in with like the less properly sort of formatted like number keypad on the device. So the product provides both options. You can do it either way. But recognizing that actually the the sort of like the wow capabilities of the device, they are actually what give that kind of sort of big impact. So planning for them, leveraging them, and then also providing kind of suitable backdoors or sort of alternatives is, I think, is super important. But, I mean, I think form factors are, they're the opportunity right now, man. We need to, like, get all excited. In fact, here's a tip. This is a suggestion from a colleague of mine, which I'm going to do on every new project. So when you're about to port an existing product over to a new form factor, make a list of all the features and functionality of the product, like down the left-hand side of the page. And then across the top, make a list of all the capabilities, the inbuilt capabilities of the new device. And then brainstorm some cool shit you could do at each intersection. Because what it does is it unlocks the potential for that device and the sort of features that are already there and amplifies them. So I don't know what that thing's called. That's like the cool shit matrix, but I'm going to start doing it. And I recommend you guys too.
So I want to make sure that we move forward on time because I think the audience probably has a few questions for us. So let's take on to our next topic, which is all about brand and relationships. And the idea here is that there's sort of multiple approaches to one conversation that people want to have, you know, with brands, or that brands want and companies want to have with their consumers. And I know that Ben has an example of a website that Method had worked on.
IDEO, actually.
same thing.
Same team, sure.
One agency or another.
Yeah, no, right, exactly. So I think brands are something that interaction designers have traditionally viewed with a level of suspicion, and that's an incorrect assumption to make. I think how you feel about a brand precurses how you are going to feel about using a product and service that that particular brand puts into the world. And so understanding how brands are formed and the kind of conversations that they end up wanting to have with the world around them is actually a vital part of interaction design. It's something that actually at Method we spend a lot of our time thinking about because our heritage is very much in the branding and graphic design world originally. So when you have a brand that wants to establish an equitable relationship with the people who are going to use its products and services, then you have you have the potential for really meaningful interactions. And so Bedsider, which is a website that's live, that I worked on with a team at IDEO, is basically, it was the intention with Bedsider was to provide a resource for young women to be educated about their contraception choices. So that's a fairly, for some people, controversial, but also a fairly dry topic. It would be great to put up like a bunch of, like, here are all the things that you can use, and here's the advantages and disadvantages of each. But what we understood very quickly is that if we actually wanted people to use this, if we actually wanted this to have impact with people, we needed a brand that supported the information that we were trying to communicate. And so Bedsider was formed. Bedsider, we described it internally, and this may make some of you cringe, so I apologize in advance, as a sex-positive brand. It's the kind of conversations you had at IDEO. But it was vitally important. So Bedsider existed. It was a brand. There were a bunch of collateral that we created to put the brand out into the world. There were some videos called Fact or Fiction, which were hilarious challenges to assumption that we'd heard women had about contraception.
Examples, please.
Yeah, so one video was called Douche and Don'ts.
Oh, God. That's fucking terrible.
We heard that some women in our initial research had interesting ideas around how you could avoid pregnancy by douching with certain material. I'll leave it
okay,
there.
Okay, no more examples.
Yeah,
we're out of time.
You asked. Yeah. So anyway, Bedsider existed, and what it actually did was reinforce the interactions that we designed and made everything much more meaningful and connect with the audience that we wanted it to connect with. Sorry.
I'm not sure how to recover from that one, actually. let's move a little bit.
We can move on.
A little bit on
shoes. That's a safe topic.
Really, this is the only picture that we could actually have after that conversation. Cleanse the palate. So, in the interest of time, I want to leave some time for questions. So, let's wrap up. Let's talk about some of the things that we've learned about what we've been talking about. Does anybody have any favorite takeaways of the conversation?
Well, I mean, I'm going to be kind of hitting people over the head to reject one-on-one mapping. Just this idea that if you're going to extend the existing product, or you're thinking about a product that goes over a bunch of different contexts, the most important thing you can do is figure out how to break out pieces of the experience that you want and figure out what's most appropriate. That rubric of appropriateness allows us to really engage with users in each context in a way that gives them the most value and is the most readily available to them in a good way. Like it's, I don't think you can just go at things and just try to replicate an experience from one context to another. You actually have to do the research. You have to design well, and you have to understand your audience in that context specifically.
Okay, I guess I would say then consider one-on-one mappings in the appropriate. No, I mean, I think.
Just being contrary.
I heard that's popular on panels at South by Southwest. No, actually, what I would say is actually adopt a service design mentality to truly understand where different people are intersecting, not just a product and a device, but the overall service. And that will help you to figure out, well, if everybody actually is just coming in on a mobile device, then maybe one-to-one mappings are something you're going to have to sort of lump it, you know, like figure out. But if we approach it from that angle, I think it helps us intelligently design.
I love what you said. I think one of the things you said was one of the most important things that was said today was the idea that you have to understand that if you have multiple contexts, there may be just one that a vast majority of your audience knows you as. They may not be aware of your mobile site, or they may not be aware of your browser site, or they may not be aware of, you know, a retail site. All these things, like, you know, Warby Parker is a good example. Foursquare is a good example. Instagram is a good example. All these things are services that exist in one context for a lot of people, and people may not know that Warby Parker has pop-up shops in San Francisco and a full-blown shop in New York. They may never go to New York and experience the actual showroom, but that it doesn't matter because you're designing for an audience and you're building something appropriate for them specifically because you know you can access them there.
Yeah.
Right. I think building on what Leah said, for me, it's using what service design tools are good at is exposing a matrix. And so what I think is most interesting about is how all of these contexts overlap. What do we understand when we add time and location and form and brand and everything else? And one of the good things that service design tools help you do is matrix that stuff out. So you have like a very interesting way of exposing opportunities at each of those intersections.
And for me, it's simply find quick, easy ways to get on your user's timeline. Mix methods that are casual research that don't take a lot of time or money, and you know, try and involve your team real time instead of presenting any kind of research that you do about people's context.
So one of the things that I sort of wanted to maybe try to sum up is, or at least point out something that we actually haven't discussed, and I'll try to say this in one sentence so that we can move on. But I think as designers, we all try to design for the ideal intended experience, right? We all want to make sure that our end users have the best experience they can with the product or the service that we're trying to put out there for. But a danger of this, though, is if we use anticipation, if we try to anticipate what people are going through when they're experiencing our products, a danger is that we're going to miss something, right? And I think, to be honest with you, I think what we have to do is be comfortable with that. And at the end of the day, we're trying to design for the best experience that we possibly can, knowing what we know through doing the rigors of research, knowing what we know from other products and services that we've designed in the past, and then just being quite possibly trying to be the best designers that we actually can be for our users. So I'll maybe end with that. And if there's any questions that anyone has, we have a mic in the front, please go ahead and come up and ask a question. We would ask, though, given the time that we have, if you have a question, just ask the question and not necessarily bring a presentation to the rest of the room with you. So hopefully everybody can appreciate that. So please jump up. I see there's a hand back there, but I don't think anybody's going to be able to hear you. So if you could hop over the mic.
Oh, yes,
maybe
they can.
All right.
Awesome. Very successfully.
So when you've got a context where people want something, but you can't deliver it,
yeah.
How do you go about explaining why they can't get that particular thing in their particular device?
That's interesting.
For example, with financial.
Yeah. Yeah.
Carefully. Carefully. You're talking about dealing with user frustration. You're talking about an instance in which, I mean, specifically with that login every time, you've got an opportunity to kind of hit them with a message at the login to say you're going to give some contextual help with that piece. You don't necessarily have to, you know, do a song and dance before they hit it, but when they're in that context, when they're in that series of behaviors within that flow, maybe do some messaging that lets them know that there are constraints and they have to be aware of them.
I think even that, though, is tricky, honestly. I think anything that's like, hey, you're not going to be able to do what you want because of X, Y, and Z just feels rude. So I actually think here's where brand matters a lot and sort of having good copywriters who actually help to make that message as palatable as possible. The other thing is, I don't always know that it's a content or a, like, how do you explain issue. I think you can actually turn it into a design opportunity as well. USAA actually has an awesome iPhone app where they basically give you the whole menu for the product before you even get into it. Like, you can see, like, oh, my account. Oh, I can transfer money. I can do all these things. And then once you actually go and try to do the thing, it'll sort of throw up the necessary security, or it'll kind of, like, gently guide you as to whether you can do that. And it's not, I don't know, it just feels more like you've already reached your destination, even though you haven't. I mean, the reality is they're authenticating everything on the other side of that, but they don't hide everything behind a wall of disclaimers and apologies, and it makes for an inviting experience. So I think, I mean, I would say try to see if you can design around it if possible too.
My experience, just to very quickly add to that, is that people respond well to clarity and honesty. So if it's something that you can be honest and clear about, then I would just say it. Like, if there's a reason why you have to keep signing in, it's because it's for your own security. Just be honest about that.
Thanks for your question.
Do we have any more questions from the audience? The mic probably works. Oh,
we have a runner now, so that's
awesome.
Thank you very much, sir.
We've got many runners, apparently. Good luck. Don't get wet, everybody.
Hi.
Oh, wait.
I think that many of the really interesting problems happen around the edges, and I haven't heard you talk much about people switching between contexts and how you design to move people or allow them to move or encourage them to move from one context to another.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, it's... Yeah,
go. Sorry, the question was around how you encourage people to move from one context to another.
You know, I actually think it's a really important question. I think it is kind of... It's the place where experiences most break down. It's like the seams between those moments. So I think I don't think there's a simple answer like, oh, always do X. I think it's just designed for that as deliberately as you design for the in moment experiences. But I think in general, the rules of the last point apply. Clarity and sort of directness in terms of this is not the, you know, we're taking you here now because this is the next best place for you to be. I think that helps at least feel like it's a guided transition as opposed to a soft one. But I know that these are very general answers to your specific question. It depends a lot, obviously, on what kinds of context you're transitioning from. But I would just say, love it up as much as you would love whatever the most interesting in-product moment is. Yeah, I mean, SnapTax, actually, the one I was talking about, is a good example of it. So it's, you know, you can take a picture of your W-2, but like most people, like, you have to have very simple taxes for that to work. So as soon as you, basically it asks you a couple questions, like it says, you know, we're trying to figure out if this is the right product for you. Let's spend a couple minutes just answering a few questions. And it says things like, are you a descendant of the Ottoman Turkish Empire? Yes. You can't use this. Let's take you over to the real product. And that's like, oh, that is fine. I'm okay with that. That's palatable. Thank you for like cushioning the blow that we're going to be transitioning by explaining why you're asking these questions.
We have the exact same problem with the About Me app. We know that we can't do full-blown curation or creation of an account in it. So we try to basically create a stub. We want you to be able to take a picture with, you know, your camera to get the account set up. But we do know that at some point we have to do kind of a handoff to the browser app. So we tried to make that as elegant as possible. And I know I can't show this to you because the app's not available yet, but hopefully you'll be able to access it soon. But no, it's a huge challenge, and just figuring out what the messaging is and where within the flow. Understand the flow, figure out when the messaging can go in, and then hit them at the optimal time so that it doesn't feel like, oh, fuck, I can't finish this. Like, it's got to be the next piece.
And nobody's solved that yet. I mean, just look at Instagram. Like, there's no easy way to transition, right? There ain't no web. So, you know, everybody's dealing with that. Anybody that promises that they figure that out is, yeah.
So given the time that it is, did we have one more question? I guess we do.
One more. This is a question about the New York Times, collection of user data. You interrupt them in the middle of being on the website, and that's really cool, but do you have to offer them any sort of incentive to participate? And do you take into account the people that are like, no, F you, I don't want to stop talking to me, I just want to read the news?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, for the people that we actually call, which is a small subset of people that fill out the screener, we always pay them just because we feel like their time is valuable. But, you know, most people don't ever receive a phone call. We're kind of counting on a funnel with that type of research. We're saying like, hey, answer a few quick questions right here. Just type what you're doing. And then we call the people that match. So those people we pay for sure because they talk to us for like a half an hour or something. But the rest of the people don't. So it's not, you know, a high dollar amount.
Do you communicate that to them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you check out Ethneo, that's the tool, and it's kind of all built in, and it says, like, hey, you know, we'll pay you if we call you and all that kind of stuff. ETHNIO.
Okay. It's awesome. You should use it.
Thanks, Lucia.
Yeah, no problem. That's I like it.
All right, well, thank you, everyone, very much for coming. We appreciate you braving the weather.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.